I'm just going to bawl my eyes out. Holy cow. Oh, it's snowing. Let's cancel. All right. Now, it's funny. I was thinking about the weathermen, and you know, in Philadelphia, that's a life or death job right there. Like, there's hostile fire pay for being a weatherman in Philadelphia. There's a guy who made a call about a storm, and it never happened, and he got death threats and had to quit and, I think, leave Pennsylvania entirely. I'm not sure, but... So I'm thankful I'm not a weatherman after last week's call that we had to make, but I'm glad to be back here today, and God has a reason for all of that, and here we are. We're going to continue along in 1 Corinthians. We're going to look at chapter 4, verses 1 through 5, servants of Christ. So the last time that we met, Paul was talking and finishing up his argument against the wisdom of the world, and having the Corinthians make sure that they are viewing everything through the foolishness of the cross. That those who are foolish, who follow Christ, are those who are truly wise and are not deceived. Paul now turns this and focuses their attention on how they are to properly view God's servants, and for that matter, all ministers in the church. So we're going to be looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 1 through 5. There's an inventor, Andrew Wilson, and he holds the patents on 14 different products. But now he's licensed something else that is uniquely his. In September 2004, Andrew Wilson went before a county judge and requested his name to be changed. We know we've talked a lot about different name changes, but this time he requested his name to be changed to They. That's correct. Immediately, Wilson was on a first name basis with the entire English-speaking world. So he changed his name to They. One reason that he said was because he was trying to have a little fun. He said, I was just trying to have a good time. Life is short, and you should try to find a way to make yourself smile. However, his insurance agent, Cindy Gossa, offered another reason. She said, They, which is Andrew's name, likes to stand out from the crowd, likes to make a name for himself. This he has achieved for now. The name is still a novelty, and They's friends are having fun with it. They're phoning him and asking, is They there? And They admits that, so when I say They, it's him, They. I know this is driving you crazy at this point. And They admits it's the name could change grammarians crazy, which I can see on your faces it is doing right now. But other than the violence his new name does to the English language, he sees the positive effects by turning a ubiquitous pronoun into his moniker. He said, there are thousands of Andrew Wilsons, and now they won't have anyone mistaking his identity. He also sees the change as an opportunity to take credit for countless actions. They do this. Who is this They that everyone is talking about? They accomplishes great things. Somebody, he said, has to take responsibility. It's funny. Here we see this gentleman, and he wants people to regard him in a certain fashion. And one of the reasons that he wants people to regard him in a certain way is because he likes to stand out from the crowd. That is often the case with titles and names in our society, is it not? We want people sometimes to know the certain labels that are attached to our names to bring us into a better light or to garner more respect from people. Well, just as we said the other week, in the kingdom of heaven, everything is what? Flipped on its head. And here, this time, Paul is doing a similar thing. He's coming before the court of the Corinthians. And he is requesting an identity. He is requesting a certain name change. And within this name, within this identity, there is a ton of meaning and application that they are to carry along with that. And they are to apply in their behavior and apply to those that minister over them. Paul doesn't want this name change to bring attention to himself. As a matter of fact, it's just the opposite. He wants them to realize how foolish it is that they are making such a fuss over certain individuals. Paul wants the Corinthian church, and he wants all of us, to regard ministers in a certain fashion, as entrusted servants of Christ, answering to the Lord of the manor. Here, Paul is painting a picture in their minds by the choice of words that he uses. Look at chapter 4, verse 1. Let a man regard us in this manner. This is how he wants to be regarded. This is how he wants to be known, as a servant of Jesus Christ and as stewards over or of the mysteries of God. So as I said, Paul is painting a picture here for the Corinthian church. They're viewing their leaders in an unhealthy fashion. They're viewing their leaders according to the ideals of this world. Paul here uses this word for servant, but it is not the same word that he used earlier in 3:5. Here, this word for servant in the original classical Greek was used of a rower on a ship of the lowest rank. Remember the movies, right? And you go down to the hull of the ship, and there are those guys rowing the boat. And I think there's still carried with it that idea behind this word. But it is more specifically here referred to and to be understood as a low-ranking house servant, someone who is an assistant, and someone who is just responsible of carrying out the task of their master. He qualifies this by saying this word, using this word steward. That is the house servant, the one who has been given a responsibility from the master. This is also carries with it an idea of one who has authority over the task and one who has the authority to accomplish the task at hand. They have been entrusted with a task, revealing the mystery of God in Christ. The Corinthian church did not give them this task, and they do not need to fulfill this task according to their preferences. And therefore, they do not respond, they do not answer to the church. Paul does not just use this term for himself, but for all ministers. We are servants with a trust. That is how we are to be viewed, each and every one of us. And what is the purpose of the servant of the household? Can we imagine going into a household and there standing a servant and the servant making a big deal about himself? The job of the servant is to do what? Serve the master. To prepare the home to bring glory to the one who owns it. Paul's not like paying it, like, hey, look at me, I'm cooking all this food, here I am. Oh, look at me, I'm cleaning the dishes. Oh, look at me, I'm polishing the brass. That's not what the servant's about. The servant has a job to do. That job was given to him by the master. And here I see three aspects of this job. Three aspects of this entrusted servant that will help us view them properly and know how to treat such individuals. The first aspect is their faithfulness is the main requirement. Their faithfulness is the main requirement. Verse 2. In this case, moreover, it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. A gentleman tells a story about going for a jog and beginning to think about an individual. This individual, John Spurgeon. Everyone know who John is? Some people do, okay. I had no idea who John Spurgeon is. The only clue that I had of who he was is because of his last name, Spurgeon. And he says this as he's jogging. He thinks to himself, what about John Spurgeon? He said, I admit not many people are losing sleep over this question. that he's been reading an autobiography of the famous British preacher Charles Haddon Spurgeon. And as you read biographies, and I've done this numerous times, as I've read biographies about great preachers or great missionaries or great ministers, what do I pray? I want to be like them, Lord. Lord, please make me like these guys. And he says, I was asking the Lord to bless my ministry like his. And then the question hit me as I began thinking about John Spurgeon. Until recent, his reading, he's never heard of him, but he was the father of Charles Spurgeon. He himself was a pastor, and he was the son of a pastor. Yet, if his son had not achieved such fame as a preacher, John Spurgeon would have served the Lord faithfully and gone to his grave, and we would never have heard of him. Hundreds of pastors like him have walked with God, he said, shepherding his flock for a lifetime and have gone to their reward without any notice in the sight of this world. He said, as I jogged, I thought, would I be willing to serve God faithfully, raise up my children to serve him, even if I never achieved any recognition? It's a good question to ask. He concludes by saying that he would do that. And he says, because in the end, the Lord doesn't say, well done, good and famous servant. He says, well done, good and faithful servant. If God makes him as famous as Charles Spurgeon, he says, that's his business. But my business is to be faithful as John Spurgeon. Here, think about that. I love this idea. You know, we have goals and ambitions, and we even place those goals sometimes and expectations on those who minister over us. But what is the main requirement here of those who are entrusted by God? Faithfulness. That is the number one requirement of all of us that are sitting in this room. At our Wise Woman this past week, we were just talking about responsibilities in the church. So this speaks to the fact that all of us have been given a certain job to do. All of us have a stewardship, folks. Each and every single one of us sitting in this room, if we have been saved by the blood of Jesus Christ, he has gifted us to do something. How many people in here have spiritual gifts? Not all, everyone. Pastor Dave, you're not raising your hand. I know you have a few. There you go. Thanks, Pastor Dave. Get it up there, Dave. All right. Woo! Got me scared there for a second. All of us have spiritual gifts. What is that? That's a stewardship. That is a responsibility. So this is very freeing, right? It's freeing because it frees us from the expectations and the opinions of others. But it is also a requirement that you and I are called to be what? Faithful. Paul was called to be faithful to the mysteries of God, to the reveal to the Corinthian church and all of those he came in contact with, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And each of us have a part to play in that. Each of us have a stewardship that we have been given. And our number one requirement that we need to ask ourselves is, are we being faithful to that? That is what matters. Not are we successful? Not are we popular? Not are we the best at what we do? But are we faithful? I remember when I was going to Bible college and I started listening to a bunch of preachers and I heard Ravi Zacharias, right? Everyone hear Ravi Zacharias, okay? I love Ravi Zacharias. And at that point in my life, I wanted to be an apologist. I wanted to go on tour and be an apologist. And I actually applied at the Ravi Zacharias ministry. And I realize now as I look back during those times that I was absolutely crazy. Because I really don't even know if I was gifted as an apologist, but I just love these guys and I wanted to be like them. And you know, you can have all your, you know, say, oh, I want to do it for the Lord and stuff like that. I don't think that was the case. I think I just wanted to be on the radio and on television. Faithfulness is the main requirement. We need to ask ourselves, what are we striving for in our ministries? Are we striving for popularity? Are we striving to beat the next guy? are we striving for worldly success? Paul and the other leaders have been given a trust, a stewardship over the mysteries of God, and they must be faithful to their task, and that is the ultimate goal. And it is the goal and the aim that each one of us that sits here today should have. In the end, this is how the servant is to be found, faithful. It is faithfulness, it is trustworthiness in the assignment that is given that is considered the ultimate success. This is how God views success, folks. He views success as faithfulness to what you have been given. He knows the resources you have been given. He knows the limitations you have been given. He knows the talents you have been given. He knows the opportunities that you have been given. Are you faithful? I point your eyes to Pastor Ted. What a great example, living example of someone who I can almost say for absolute certain that he's going to hear those words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." There's an example before us. Paul wants ministers to be found faithful. And here the steward is in a position of trust and faithfulness, and this trust that he has been given is the criteria in which he is judged in the end. And it is seen, this expectation is seen in this ancient document. Listen to this document. And this is a document written by the master to the steward over the house. He says, "I have empowered you by this document to administer my estate in Arsinoe and to collect the rents, and if need be, to arrange new leasers and to cultivate the land yourself." So there's the responsibilities. "And to give receipts in my name." There's his authority. "To transact any business connected with the stewardship, just as I can transact it when I am present. To distribute plots and caramis, restoring to me what remains over." There's who he's doing it for. "As to which I rely on your good faith and confirm whatever you decide about them." So here we see there is an expectation. There's the task that is laid out. There is the authority to do it. And how is he to do it? He's to do it faithfully. Paul is taking this requirement because the Corinthians are placing other worldly requirements on him, other expectations that he's like, "Look, I don't answer to you guys. I answer to the master. He gave me the task. My task is to make known the gospel, and I cannot do anything that is going to hinder that task." Hence, the world's wisdom. We carry out and we place these expectations on those who minister to us in the church, and that's just not right, folks. We have expectations, we have things people need to do, but the ultimate expectation is their faithfulness to the task that has been given. We may not apply such worldly standards to others or to ourselves. Maybe you're in a ministry and you don't think you're very successful right now. You don't think you're successful because you're using worldly standards to determine that success. God is responsible for our success. Our job is to carry out that ministry through the strength that He provides. It all goes back to depending on Him. He is the one who knows what the gifts that you have are. He knows your strengths and talents. He knows your opportunities. He knows the life difficulties that you're dealing with. And our job is to be faithful in that. That's what we're trying to do here at Galilee. We have an opportunity to reach the community in our area, right? We can go out and we can preach the gospel. Thousands of people may get saved. Hundreds of people may get saved. Tens of people may get saved. Or absolutely no one may get saved. Is that our fault? No. What's our job? To be faithful. We need to take the opportunities. We need to use the resources God's given us. Everything we got, we put towards that, but success depends on Him. We're looking for a pastor, an assistant pastor right now. And we have a lot of different qualifications, folks. And those qualifications are necessary. And we're going to have some responsibilities for this individual to do. But what's the main thing that we are to be looking for? This. That they realize that they have been given a trust, a stewardship, and that they are faithful to carry that out. The second aspect that I see here is their conscience belongs to the Lord, verses 3 and 4. So Paul takes this truth and this maxim, and then he applies it to himself, because the Corinthian church were examining him. They were reviewing him. And he says, look, the number one qualification for stewards is faithfulness. Therefore, he says this, but to me, it is a very small thing that I may be examined by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even examine myself, for I am conscious of nothing against myself, yet I am not by this acquitted, but the one who examines me is the Lord. Ken Elzinga tells a story about when he joined the faculty of University of Virginia at the age of 26. So shortly after he joins this group of teachers, there was a colleague there, and this individual found out that Ken was a Christian. She came up to Ken and told him that he needs to be very careful about being explicit with regards to his faith, that it would hinder his career. So that was his introduction into the faculty. It's funny because I actually had someone say that to me at Long Creek. They saw a bumper sticker on my car, and this individual is very clear. Hey, you don't say anything about Jesus Christ in here and this and that. And they just made it very clear, and I'll tell you who it is later, Brian. But yeah, they made it very, very clear that I was not. So here this guy comes in, he's all excited, gets this new job, and then someone says, hey, don't say anything about your faith. It's going to hinder your career. And then after that conversation, right, he goes and he sees a flyer posted at a very popular campus location with his face on it, giving a Christian lecture. So he had agreed to do this lecture, and there he is. He sees his face in that flyer, and after hearing this from his colleague, he gets all nervous and worried, and he's worried. And he's like, Lord, is this going to hinder my career? And he's stressing all over it. He goes back home, and in the middle of the night, he secretly sneaks back on the campus, and he takes down that flyer. He said, but he changed his mind. He said that the next morning he went back and he put the flyer back up because he concluded that his life was not about career ambition but about faithful discipleship, and that being private about his faith was not an option. In the 4 decades since then, he's been named Professor of the Year multiple times and is still a speaker in high demand. He will be the first to say that serving only one master is liberating. Why? Because pleasing an audience of one makes us less anxious, less sensitive to criticism, and more courageous. Because in doing so, we become more secure and compete less for our honor. Folks, that is what Paul is doing here. He is serving an audience of one. It is the one that matters. He is the only one ultimately that can judge our faithfulness. Faithfulness is the main requirement, and it is faithfulness to the task, ultimately to the one who gave it to us. Therefore, what others think of us as we carry out that task matters absolutely nothing as long as we are faithful to the task he has given us, right? That's it. And here, it's applied to, in the illustration, it's applied to unbelievers. But believe me, this applies in the church, folks. I know that many people have many different opinions about me as I stand up here, as I preach, as I do things. And Paul is not being flippant here. And he's not saying, hey, who are you to judge me? You have no one to judge me. What he's letting us know is that our conscience belongs to the Lord ultimately, that human judgment is flawed. And humans are going to have opinions, they're going to have expectations. But the one opinion that matters is the opinion of Jesus Christ. It's one thing that I've learned very quickly in the ministry, that you cannot please everyone all the time. Do you know that? Do we all realize that? That there are people that are going to be unhappy with what we do. I've seen it. I've done it. You know, sometimes they were right. I shouldn't have done it, and I learned a lesson. But other times, you just got to move on. Here, the Corinthians are in the process of examination. They haven't reached a verdict. But the verdict, good or bad, has very little impact on Paul. A wise man once said to me, don't believe your own press, good or bad. Paul doesn't know basically what the outcome of the verdict. Some people may have a verdict of, oh, we like Paul. Some people may have an outcome of a verdict, oh, we don't like Paul. Guess what? Doesn't matter. I like that statement, don't believe your own press, good or bad, because what can happen if we believe our good press, and we want to believe the good press, right? We ignore the bad press, and we want to believe the good press, but then our head gets inflated. And if we believe the bad press, then we just wallow in mire and self-pity. All human examination is flawed, and only one who can judge us unbiasedly is the one who knows all, and that's the master of the servant. Paul, though he in one sense belongs to the Corinthians, he ultimately belongs to the Lord, and because he belongs to the Lord, his conscience does as well. He gives that over to God. And as I said before, it doesn't mean that we don't examine our ministers, right? We realize that that's not what he's saying here ultimately. I like how John MacArthur puts it, because the Corinthians' knowledge and their understanding of the facts are imperfect, so are their criticisms and compliments imperfect. In humility and love, those who minister must not allow themselves to care about others' evaluations of their ministry. Another commentator says this is a sober way in which any Christian is to think of him or herself in relationship to the opinions of others. That's great advice, because so many times we find ourselves going back and forth trying to what? Please the opinions of others. Trying to meet expectations that God has not placed on us. We place them on ourselves, or others place them on us. What is the way that he views their opinions? I love this phrase because it really speaks to how he sees them and how much they weigh. How many times do we feel, especially in ministry, do we feel like we're underneath that magnifying glass of others and people are just picking out things and they're like, look, I see you do that. I don't like how you do that. I like how you do that. That's okay. You're going to have to change your clothes. You're going to have to do this and this and whatever it is. And we feel like we're under the magnifying glass. Well, Paul says that it is of little consequence, and it really helps to understand what he's saying here. This is the superlative of the word micros. It is the exaggerated form of microscopic, basically. That is how small he counts their opinions, like that. So what we need to do is we need to flip that magnifying glass around, and that's how we have to view those opinions of others, because they're that small. That's how he views them. And if they're that small, we can carry 1,000 of them on our person, can we not? They don't weigh a thing. So what are you saying? They're examining him. And they're examining him with expectations that God has not placed on him. Not only does he say this about their opinions, but he says no human court can judge him. He's talking, it means to have your day in court, right? He's saying not, why? Because all human judgment is flawed. Your examination is flawed. And we have to, in humility, realize that. Yes, we evaluate work, we evaluate people's jobs, and we need to do that, and I need to be evaluated. But ultimately, Jesus Christ does the evaluating, folks, because he sees much, much more than we can ever see in an individual. Paul is not excusing himself from evaluation, and we are told to examine ourselves, but we tend to mostly overestimate the good that we do, and we tend to be hard on the stuff that we fail in. You ever just dig deep into yourself? He says, I don't even examine myself. That's an amazing statement. It doesn't mean, because it doesn't mean he's not looking at his heart and making sure there's not any sin, because he says, I am conscious of nothing. So if we're not conscious of any sin, right, if we keep digging deep into ourselves, what are we going to find? A bunch of mess. That's what happens with me. The deeper you go, the darker it gets. You just end up being like, what on earth am I doing? I've done it so many times preparing for a sermon. I come to a text and I'm like, Lord, you're going to have to cancel church next week because I can't preach this text. Why? Because I fail at it miserably. Miserably. But if I were to do that, what's going to happen? That's focusing on who? Me. It's focusing on this guy. And it's not about me. It's about my master. Because he is the one, that's a perfect timing. Good. That's great. See, they like that, whoever did. They're calling in. And in some, we just get so caught up in all of this evaluation. And we try to please, you know, we try to do it for ourselves. We try to make ourselves feel better about who we are. And we try to please others. You know, I want to be cool. I want to be hip. I want to be liked. I want to be funny. And you get caught up in this roller coaster, right? And you're just going up and down and up and down. What happens if you live your ministry like that? You throw up. You know, a roller coaster, that's all you're going to do. You get sick. It's not healthy for anyone. It's not healthy for us to place expectations on people that God hasn't placed, and it's not healthy for us to place expectations on ourselves. Give your conscience to the Lord. Ultimately, he has the final say. The third and final aspect of this is their evaluation. The servant's evaluation is when their Lord returns, verse 5. So he applies the maxim to himself, and he frees his conscience from their opinion, and then he applies it to them. Because Jesus is the one who examines me, therefore, stop judging. Therefore, do not go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, who will bring both to light the things hidden in darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts. And then each man's praise will come to him from God. Paul just got finished saying that there is only one individual that knows the entire story. Jesus is the one who examines him. The Lord, the Master, the one who has given him the task, the resources, the talents, the gifts, all of that. He knows it all. And therefore, he is the one who examines him. And that judgment is not now, folks. That judgment comes later. So stop judging now. There is only one individual who knows the entire story. He takes this truth of the requirement of faithfulness to his Lord and the task, and as I said, he applies it to himself, and then he applies it to the church. If this is the case, then we need to stop engaging in such a behavior. One, we're not qualified to judge the Lord's servant. Two, we're way too early. Their evaluation is coming, so there will be an evaluation, but that evaluation is not yet. It is an examination that will come not from humans, but it will come from when the master of the house returns. And then and only then will the motives and the reasons for doing things and the impetus for the work be revealed, no sooner and not by humans. So given the truth that their evaluation comes later, then we as individuals need to do three things: stop, drop, and wait. We need to stop judging, we need to drop our opinions, and we need to wait for the Lord. The Lord will bring these things to light, but we love to jump to judgments and conclusions. I love this. I had to put this up there. If jumping to conclusions was an Olympic event, I would have broken the world in Olympic records. That's what humans love to do. We just do it. I do it all the time. Jump to conclusions. I can meet an individual and I can tell you everything about that person in 2 seconds. I just look at them, see how they act, see how they talk, see what they're wearing. It's in our nature. We're guilty of doing it constantly. And Paul warns us against doing it against God's ministers. That is an evaluation that we are not qualified for, that we are not qualified to give. It's so funny because as I was preparing this point the other week, I had an illustration down for this. And I actually changed my illustration because God gave me a lifetime real, like in present illustration of this event. So I go, after I got done here at work, I went over to a Goodwill, surprisingly. I stop at a Goodwill. And there I am, I'm wandering, it's on my way home, the one in Westbrook or something like that, and I'm wandering around, and I find this lovely incense, German incense burner. Have you guys ever seen any of these? If you find these, pick those up. I'll give you $5 for it, and then I'll sell it for $150. So it's an old antique German incense burner. And there, and I love that this one actually has like a musical quality too. So it's a music box, and then you stick the little incense in the guy's mouth, and they're hand-carved, and they're highly, highly collectible. So I put that little puppy in my shopping cart, and I get ready to check out. And there's this young girl, and she's standing over by the clothing rack, and she's looking at the clothes. And I ask her, I said, "Excuse me, are you in line?" And she looks at me, and she's like, "No." And I should have realized right there I was in a lot of danger. And she's a young girl. I didn't even think anything of it, but the way she said no, I was just a little freaked out. So I get in line, and I'm standing with my card there, and there she is. She's looking, and she keeps coming, looking back at the little plane in my thing. And usually what happens is I find really strange stuff at Goodwill, and I buy them. And usually people strike up a conversation. So I was going to take the opportunity and strike up a conversation. I love meeting and talking to people, and we talk usually about the weird things that I have in my cart. So I was just about to say something, and then all of a sudden, without looking at me, I hear her say, "It's really weird that you're buying Nazi memorabilia." And the other guy next to me hears it in line, and I'm just like, "Whoa, what do you mean?" I mean, this guy is far from hurting anybody. So here's the thing. I understand the misconception because the cross on there is the German Iron Cross. But who is this guy? Do you guys know who this is? Snoopy? Red Baron, right? This is a Red Baron, World War I. Iron Cross, yes, they still use it in World War II, so I can understand that. But what I don't get is her judgment to the fact that I'm like some sort of Nazi sympathizer. So here I am, and I have a choice, right? At this point, I can ignore this girl, and I can just be like, "Oh, okay, you know, I'm just going to ignore her." But and I didn't do that. No. No, I didn't. I couldn't do that. I have an opportunity. I'm a teacher. I have an opportunity to teach. I'm going to take it. So I start talking. I said, no, you're wrong. I understand this isn't the Nazi. This isn't the swastika. This is World War I. This is the Red Baron, Snoopy, you know, and trying, you know. And as I'm talking to her, she says, "I don't want to engage with you in this any further." I'm like, "Too late. You started this. We're like in this. You're the one who came swooping out of the sky and strafed me in the middle of the line. I don't want to engage you." So then I shut up for 2 seconds because I thought about it. And then I thought, I'm thinking of my sermon. And I'm like, this is crazy. This is what I'm talking about. And I in a serious face, I was like, you know, look, you missed an opportunity. You missed an opportunity to know someone because you jumped to a conclusion. And then she just stormed off and didn't say anything. And I thought that was, and the people, and it's funny, the workers there know me. They know I'm a pastor. And one lady said to me, of all the people, she wanted to know. And the one guy's like holding this German beer stein. He's like, I'm a Nazi too. But here it was really serious. I said, this is what's wrong with the world, right? Here she's thinking I'm a Nazi sympathizer and I'm the furthest thing from it. I hate the Nazis. It's not, I am so against everything of that they stand for. Little did she know that I'm a person that teaches about love and respect and helping the oppressed, fighting against evil. We jump to conclusions without the proper information. There is one person who knows us fully. His name is Jesus Christ. Therefore, we need to stop judging before the appointed time. I know what shoes taste like. I have a flavor for shoes because I put my foot in my mouth quite often. And you think that we would learn after having incidents like this, but we don't. And that's why Paul is reminding us, hey, look, there's a time when these guys are going to be judged. There's a time when each and every one of us, and he's kind of flipping the tables a little bit, and he's saying, look, even you too are going to be evaluated, and the motives behind what you are doing are going to be shown for what they are. And this is encouraging for us and also a slight warning for us as well. Because many times in ministry, we can be misunderstood. We may do things that people are going to respond negatively towards. People may not know why we do things, or they may think that we do things for wrong reasons. For those of us who go through that, here we have this truth of waiting. That's what we're to do. Once again, given our conscience to him, but given the evaluation to him in the end, knowing that in the end, everything is going to be brought to light. Here, this is the master of the home, the master who has given the task to this servant. What does he do? He comes on, he turns on all the lights in the house, right? And everything's going to be seen for what it is, both good and bad. And then he says this absolutely, all this, so it's all the desires, it's the intentions, and of course the motives behind it. And then he says this great phrase, and their praise and the praise, and man, each man's praise will come to him from who? From God. He ends, folks, where it all needs to start for each one of us. We seek not man's praise. We seek God's praise. And if we're seeking after God's praise, we'll be found faithful. The Corinthians loved the praise of man. This is where they got it wrong. This is where we get it wrong, too. It's amazing to think that the one who we should be praising is going to give praise to us. I don't deserve that. None of us do. But it's coming if we are faithful servants. And faithful servants give their conscience over to the Lord, and they wait for that time to be judged. Father, thank you for the truths that we read here today, Lord, and thank you for reminding us to ultimately seek after your praise, not the praise of man. Help us, each and every one of us, help us to know the stewardship that you have given us, Lord, Help us to be faithful to that stewardship, Lord. Lord, and as we begin to worship you again, I pray that we take a few moments and just reflect on the truths that we heard here today. Lord, help us to give our minds, our hearts, and our souls to you and your service, not for our praise, but for your praise. In Jesus' name, amen.